Spark Media presents Cosmic Creatures by Jason Kent Nord. Performed for you by Adam Anagnostou, Mike Kelly, John Yonker, and Luke Langfeld. Sound design by Dan Steffens. This episode contains content that may be alarming to some listeners. Please check the episode notes for more detailed descriptions. And now, episode 13, Light and Sound.
The sound of my blood pulsing and my heart pounding is almost overwhelming. I can even taste a hint of iron. After running for at least 3 miles, longer than I've run since, high school, I can't ignore my body's alarm bells anymore. I have to stop. My lungs have been burning for the last 2 miles, and my ribs have been screaming at me to stop the whole time. The burning in my legs is just an afterthought. Another 3 miles and I'll be home. Or what used to be home. But first, I have to stave off an impending heart attack. Seriously, I need to stop to stay alive. The phrase, "more bombs coming," has been echoing repeatedly in my head. Yet, as each minute passes in silence, I wonder why they've stopped. Only one explosion has been heard and felt so far, and it confuses me. I would have expected more by now, and the reprieve feels almost too good to be true. Maybe they realized there are still kids in the area and stopped to evacuate them. I pray that's the case, and I pray the kids are still alive and not badly injured, but I ain't putting all my faith in prayers alone. Be it through my efforts or the military's, someone needs to reach them. I just hope it doesn't have to be me. With my heavy breathing and pounding heartbeats easing back from the brink of catastrophe, I press onward at a mere stroll. Slow is better than stopped. I can smell it now. Smoke. So far, the moonlight and clear air have given me a good measure of vision, but I can see now it's darker and hazier up ahead. It's been a fairly calm evening, but I believe I'm upwind of anything. The change has prompted me to speed up, but it's a short-lived progression. My lungs, absorbing the first inhales of polluted air, are sounding alarms again. I have to stop again already. I'm dizzy, weary, and my vision is suffering from more than the changing light. I think I'm going to pass out. Serious as a heart attack. I might actually be having one. I drop to the ground. Hands and knees hold me up as I heave with every breath, consumed with the need to not pass out. The air is a little cleaner near the ground, it seems. I need to take a solid 5 minutes here. I can't help Kale if I die. I need to quiet my mind. Breathe. Recover. I'll get there. I've never been zen or meditative by any stretch of the imagination, but I suddenly feel an overwhelming need to relax. My body has been screaming for it like my life might depend on it. Just calm down. Relax, Russell. Breathe. Bit by bit, it feels productive. The threat of imminent death begins to fade. The panting gives way to deeper breaths. Something crashes through the brush only a few yards away. The unknown invader induces the return of a panicked state, but instead of flooding my every breath, it freezes me up. In fact, my breathing stops as my eyes seek the threat while my head remains still. A yellowish glow streaks between the trees and noisily churns through the brush. Catching a longer glimpse, I recognize it as the little hunchback that killed Gus. It's moving fairly fast. It bursts onto the road 20 yards ahead, pivots to follow the open path, and trudges off in the same direction I'd been going. I'm afraid to move or even attempt to hide lest it see or hear me. "Keep going," I internally plead with the creature. My frozen state is taking its toll. I need to breathe again. I resist it for a few moments. The thing is creating distance. A few moments more, and I'm clear of danger. I collapse and roll onto my back. Every ounce of focus and energy returns to the matter of breathing. I have to find that calm again immediately. Breathe. 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 Salvation comes more slowly this time. It feels like an eternity before I feel that I am out of danger. Well, medical danger, anyway. Man, if I hadn't stopped when I did, I'm lucky to be alive. Let's hope the same is true for Kale.
Once back at the house, Ellie entertained Galileo in the yard, while Nick decided it was time to relocate the muscle cat's carcass to the side of the house, allowing us to gather in the garage with the door closed. This would help avoid any surprise guests like Slicer, and provide them with something else to feed on, if that's what they come looking for. Fitch, not wanting to get drafted to deal with that, volunteered to help me gather equipment. His clumsiness and stream of questions and comments weren't really all that helpful, but at least he carried a couple things without breaking them. Nick hosed down the garage floor and swept out gross remnants of blood and fur, but the garage still had a bit of a musty smell, slightly masked by the scent of smoke from the charred terrain outside. I did my best to ignore the smells. Thankfully, Galileo seemed content enough to join us in the garage, and I was amazed that closing the garage door didn't seem to bother him. It was still disconnected from the motor, though, so perhaps it would have been a different experience if we hadn't closed it manually. I took the only spot to sit, the garage step that leads into the house, to arrange my equipment. My dinosaur of a laptop, speakers, a handheld parabolic mic, a decibel meter, and a spectrum analyzer. For all of Dad's faults, he came through with good gifts for Christmas and my birthdays. But at least half of the stuff I've acquired I bought with money I made working summers. As I got ready, Ellie was inside the house calling her dad. We stupidly left the radio in the cave, each of us thinking someone else had it. We debated having someone go get it, but we need to stick together. I feel like we are headed back to set a trap there soon enough anyway. He didn't answer, Ellie relays as she re-enters the garage, squeezing by me and using my head as a railing, which it actually gives me a bit of goosebumps. "Hey, check this out," says Fitch. He has my laser pointer and is teasing Galileo, who's chasing the beam around like a cat. "Stop teasing him," Ellie admonishes. And yet, the interaction inspires a thought in me. "Wait," I say. "Do you have any Christmas lights?" Nick and Ellie both give me a funny look, confused for a moment, before Nick grows curious. "What you thinking?" he asks. "Well, their planet has lots of colorful light," I start.
"They invented light bulbs, too?" Fitch chirps.
"Well, no. They obviously don't have electricity on their planet. But it must be a pretty luminescent environment. To me, it was the most amazing thing about the place when I first saw it. I bet the darkness of our planet is really strange to them." I nod at Galileo. I want to see how he reacts to light and darkness. Before I can fully spit it out, Fitch switches off the garage light. A little moonlight from the windows makes vision possible but limited. After a moment, Galileo's rather dull brown luminescence is the brightest light source in the garage. The energy he gathered from chasing the laser light dissipates quickly. He steps over to Ellie and lies down at her feet, just as he had laid at my feet in the cave. Nick heads over to some storage containers in the back of the garage and asks for some light, but Fitch interrupts.
"Wait! I know!"
He recklessly barges past me into the house, barely giving me time to be alarmed about him breaking something among my gathered gear. I scooch the gear over a bit out of caution for his return. Then I power my equipment on, put on the headphones, and point the mic at Galileo. I lean toward him to gather his attention.
"Hey, buddy,"
I say. There's a quick response. The decibels are low, between 2.5 and 2.9 hertz. While the lower range of human hearing is commonly thought to bottom out around 20 hertz, it might be possible to hear waves down to 1.5 hertz, but only in an extremely quiet, sterile environment.
"He's talking," I announce.
"What's he saying?"
asks Nick, only partly kidding.
"No clue,"
I reply excitedly, before getting more serious about it. It's at low hertz levels. Infrasound. I need to record this. I reach over and flip on the recorder. Nick has succeeded in finding Christmas lights in the boxes he was digging through, and is trying to untangle them as he takes them over to his socket. "Want me to plug them in?" he asks. I nod, but realize that may not be enough in the dim light, and add verbally, "Yeah." Nick plugs them in, and the effect on Galileo is immediately evident. He bounces up in surprise and goes quiet. The mic begins to pick up a few sounds that grow a little steadier, as Galileo seems to adopt an affinity for the lights. In fact, he promptly nestles down next to them on the floor. Ellie, Nick, and I are all smiling and trading knowing glances. The peaceful moment is quickly dashed as Fitch comes barreling back into the garage. I flinch as he smacks a hand on my head for support while descending the step, despite the extra room I gave him. Definitely no goosebumps this time. As he dashes over to the wall socket, I see he's carrying a couple of my lights. A strobe light that I bought for an experiment and a party light that Dad got me shortly thereafter, that swirls bright colors at different speeds and intensifies in sync with music. It wasn't one of Dad's best gifts, but he was trying.
"Check this out," says Fitch eagerly.
He plugs in the strobe and the room is consumed by the harsh fluttering effect, alternating between almost blinding brightness and the much darker but colored atmosphere of the Christmas lights. Galileo flips out. He spazzes about the room, audibly chattering.
"Stop!" I yell. "Turn it off! Turn it off!"
Ellie slaps on the overhead garage light as Nick yanks the plug from its socket. Galileo is pacing about with narrower eyes, albeit not fully in his beady-eyed beast mode.
"He didn't like that," I point out.
"Sheesh," Fitch pouts. "Some planets just don't know how to party."
He holds up the other light.
"What about this?"
he asks me. As much as I want to tell Fitch to stop, I am curious as to how Galileo would react. I know that without music, the light is fairly calm, and its blue, red, green, and yellow swirls should be far less abrasive than the striking bright strobes. I nod, giving Fitch the go-ahead. He plugs it in, and the colorful lights spin around, adding only a touch of atmosphere with the overhead light still on. I nod to Ellie, who is silently checking with me that it's okay to turn the overhead light off. As the light goes off, the room fills with color. I train the mic on Galileo. His hesitation is only momentary, before he relaxes and begins some infrasonic chatter. And then, to our great surprise, he prances about the middle of the room, seeming to admire this new effect. I remember that, along with all the various frequencies I was going to test out on Galileo, I have a music file I could play. I open the music file and some indie pop begins to play. It's a group called Hippocampus, based out of Minnesota. I couldn't resist a band named for a part of the brain. It's good stuff. Mellow and peppy at the same time. I turn it up.
"Nice,"
Ellie approves. I'll be damned if Galileo's response isn't the equivalent of dancing. He patters around like a happy puppy chasing its tail or invisible fleas. Even Ellie and Nick sway a bit.
"What is this crap?" complains Fitch. "Play some Megadeth or something."
With that comment interrupting the welcome moment, it occurs to me that we have a time pressure here, and I reluctantly turn off the music. Galileo seems to have tired himself a bit and goes over to the Christmas lights and nestles back down. Although I'm satisfied that we've learned a lot in these few minutes, and although it makes me a bit nervous, I figure there's one more test we should cover. We need to test ultrasonic—
"Hey! You guys!"
Fitch interrupts. He spotted something in the corner and dashes over to it. He lifts up a crate of fireworks.
"Check this out!" he proudly displays. "We need to test these!"
"No way!" Ellie objects, and turns to me for confirmation. Fitch might be onto something, though. If lights and noise draw their attention, the fireworks may actually be quite useful in setting a trap. But of course, we don't need to test that here.
We'd probably gather immediate attention and get someone hurt. They might come in handy. Later, I add flatly.
Okay. Well, where are we at? Says Nick.
We know they use infrasound and, like, colorful lights and music. So, if we use all of this, how do we trap or kill them?
Good point. I scan the room. A trap might need to be electrical. Wiring is easier than arranging a sturdy enough physical barrier. I immediately spot a spool of wire sitting by Dr. Hagen's tools on the back workbench. In the garage rafters, I spot some long copper pipes, undoubtedly left over from some plumbing project. I also see a spare car battery in one corner. But there's no telling how much charge it has, and I doubt it would provide a strong enough current. And then I spy a real asset. In another corner, partially obstructed by clutter, is a gas generator.
I bet old man Corver has some guns, Fitch offers.
He could be right. I remember Mr. Carver's pickup having stickers for Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever.
Birdshot isn't going to bring down some of these beasts, though. I want to say I saw a buck in the back of his pickup once, but maybe it's wishful thinking.
You two go get them, I tell Nick and Fitch. Ellie and I'll gather everything else.
I've never experienced anxiety like this before. Hours spent in a captivating alien environment now contrast with navigating what should be familiar, comfortable, earthly terrain. Yet it's dark and eerie, and I'm effectively leading a search party for my missing kids. And there are vicious beasts on the loose. I have both a hatred and appreciation for my fellow searchers. All I want is to reach that cave, find my kids, and proceed from there. Thankfully, it's just ahead. Fed up with the slow pace, the soldiers insisted on leading despite their unfamiliarity with the surroundings. I forge ahead. Kids! I shout. Ellie! Nick! Kale! There's no answer as we break into the clearing in front of the cave. Darting toward the opening, I'm grabbed from behind. Colonel Harstead has a firm grasp of my arm.
Let them clear it! He orders, motioning to the men.
They move so swiftly, my grunts fill the moment before words can come. Quickly, I hear them call, "Clear!" I dash inside as a soldier's flashlight fills the cave. No kids. Before any doubts about the location can form, I spy a radio lying on a knee-high ledge. "They were here," I say, charging over to retrieve the radio. My heart pounds like never before. A release from the anxiety not only eludes me, it intensifies. Where did they go now? Are they okay?
Where to now?
Colonel Harstead asks, wasting no time. Our home is a half mile to the west, I say. It's the only place that makes any sense, and while the only thing that really matters is the safety of the kids, I'm anxious to see what condition it's in after that bomb dropped. Without hesitation, we file out of the cave. The soldiers vaguely drift westward.
Follow me, dammit, I bark.
The trail is well-defined, so I suppose they could lead. But screw it. It's narrow, and I'm leading. And they can shut up or fight me.
2 miles of mostly walking is killing me mentally more than physically. Who walks to the aid of their child, for fuck's sake? But the need to remain stealthy and alive has limited me to only light jogging, and for no more than a minute or two at a time. A sight interrupts my pity party. There's a vehicle parked up ahead, and there seems to be movement inside in a soft purple light, like from a cell phone. I can't imagine what someone would be doing just parked there. As I close in, it hits me. The damn car's smashed into a tree at the edge of the road. It's the McDermott's ancient station wagon, and the light inside is no cell phone. There are creatures inside, and they're glowing like that creepy hunchback did. They look fairly small, but I have no interest in coming face to face with any of these freaky things. Can the things get out? Is a window open? Is there a person in there that they're feeding on? Believe me, I don't want to know, but I need to know. As unlikely as it would be, I have to make sure Kale isn't in there. I can't just go rushing up, so I crouch down, low, along the very edge of the road and move closer. From a distance, it looks like all the passenger side windows are shut. There's also a big chunk of tree bark lying in the road. I need to circle around to get a view of the driver's side, but I don't really want to leave the road and start breaking twigs and rustling leaves underfoot. I take calculated but swift steps. I can't mess around anymore. Kale might need me. Each slight noise I make fills me with another ounce of terror that I will be spotted. It takes a good 30 steps to get a decent view. It looks like the windows are closed. Yes, I'm sure of it. I should be good unless the rear is open. I grunt and press on, giving less of a damn about making minor noises. The back end is sealed tight. I never understood why Greg kept this gas-guzzling tub. Apparently, he grew up in it, and it was passed down when his old man kicked the bucket. I guess they bonded over fixing it up together. He always griped about how modern cars are all computerized junk. Well, if Greg's still breathing, he's got some big repairs to make now. I don't like the thought of finding him, his wife, or anybody else's dead body. I mean, there's virtually no way Kale is in there, but I need to get closer to see what's on the seats. As I approach, those squirrely little alien rodents come into view inside. They spot me and go into a frenzy, scurrying around the whole interior while chirping at me. It takes me a hot minute to feel secure about their captivity and muster the nerve to get closer, to see what else may be in there with them. There's a carcass for damn sure. But relief surges through me as I recognize it's some pinkish creature that's also not of this world. No sign of Kale. Thank God. Good. Tear each other apart, I growl under my breath. I wish I could use this tank to drive the rest of the way. The keys are in the ignition, but there's no way in hell I'm letting these things loose. Not when it looks like they want a piece of me for dessert.
Walking in the woods at night, knowing there are unknown threats all about, is unnerving. Here I am, an adult with a military escort, and I'm still trying to keep my wits about me. I can't even begin to fathom how the kids are handling this. They must be terrified out of their minds. Then the sight of something stops me dead in my tracks. Doing so startles the guys on my heels, who immediately begin scanning and pointing their weapons all around. I point. Up by a tree branch is a bit of tangerine-hued goo. It's completely out of place. Looking down to the ground below, I see them. There, I point again. Black, leathery things oozing more of the goo. They've been shot. One of the guys with a rifle jumps into position, gun trained on them. An understandable but silly reaction. They're clearly dead. These were on the inventory, I recall. Security called in two of these so far, but both were in town. Looks like the kids got this pair. It makes me proud, concerned, and upset all at the same time. It shouldn't be kids out here doing this work, and it hurts me to think that they must have felt unsupported as they bravely took this upon themselves. And yet, they are quite clearly succeeding.
Call it in,
Colonel Harstead quietly instructs his radio man. Too bad they haven't been getting any help, I say, leveling a glare at the colonel.
Keep moving,
he counters. A soldier takes the lead now, and we hardly travel another 50 feet before he stops suddenly, whipping his rifle towards something off the trail. We crowd around it. A large rock has smashed a strange pile of limbs. It oozes an ochre goo. Exhibit 29, I believe. Yes, I'm sure of it. Call that one in, too. And take some freaking notes, boys, I say. The children have got us down to the last dozen at most. I don't even care that the colonel's scowl indicates that I'm testing his patience. Fuck it. That felt fun to say.
We hope you've enjoyed Cosmic Creatures, a Spark Media production. This program was directed and executive produced by H.G. Zeisler, featuring the voice talents of Adam Anagnostou as Kale Rhodes, Mike Kelly as Russell Rhodes, John Yonker as Dr. Elliot Hagen, and Luke Langfelt as Major Roggy. Text copyright 2022 by Jason Kent Nord. Illustrations including cover and episode art by Meredith Tuvey. Sound design by Dan Steffens. Story edits by Emily Nord and H.G. Zeisler. A special thanks to our founding Spark storytellers. Rest assured that no animals, cosmic or earthly, were harmed in the production of this episode. Enjoyed what you heard? Check out more Spark stories and find out more about Spark Media on our website, sparkmedia.com. That's sparkmedia.com. Or check us out on Instagram or Facebook at Spark Media. Links and episode notes. Interested in telling stories? Apply to be a Spark storyteller today. We're looking for writers, editors, composers, voice talent, and more. It takes a village to tell a story, and we need you. Link in episode notes. Audio production copyright 2024 by Spark Media LLC, all rights reserved.